Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
If Iran resumes its full compliance with the deal, we will do the same.
Looming deadlines and a foreign policy test for President Biden. Iran demands action to re-enter the nuclear deal. As Western leaders meet to confer, how will the U.S. respond? Then...
We are rising!
The Black Church was more than just a spiritual home. It was the epic center of Black life.
Communities anchored in faith, tracing the rich history and influence of the Black Church in America. Director Stacey Holman on the story and the song. And...
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
The United States versus Billie Holiday. Lee Daniels joins our Michelle Martin to discuss his new film and the campaign to silence Holiday's strange fruit. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Now, China may be the number one strategic foreign policy challenge for both the United States and Europe, but President Joe Biden, and indeed Europe, faces many other important tests in these early days. Should the United States honor former President Trump's deal to pull out all U.S. troops from Afghanistan? Should Biden reverse Trump's withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA? Today, top American and European diplomats met to figure out how to revive that deal. And the head of the UN Atomic Energy Agency will travel to Tehran this weekend to try to head off Iran's threat to reduce cooperation with its nuclear inspectors. Now, amid a public game of chicken over who goes first, tonight, key players from the Obama administration and the European Commission join me. First, we're going to the former administration advisor, Vali Nasser. Welcome back to the program, Vali Nasser. Can I ask you just to weigh in on whether you think that actually there is this game of chicken being played? Who's on first? Will the U.S. go back into the deal first? Will Iran go back into the deal first? Is that really an issue?
It is an issue because it's a big issue for the Iranians in terms of trusting the United States. And also the supreme leader in Iran has spoken very clearly saying that Iran will not go ahead of the United States and will not be more compliant than the United States. And I think since President Biden has not said anything about Iran since he's come to power, I think the Iranians are worried that he's going to use the leverage of the Trump years in order to force their hand. So I think they're serious about this, and they have held their gunpowder while Trump was president, hoping for a change of U.S. policy when Biden comes in. And I think they haven't seen that, so they're getting anxious about how serious the U.S. is and whether the U.S. will really lift sanctions. So I think they're under some pressure domestically to carry through with their threat.
So the European Commission head today said, and I'll read it, European Council President Charles Michel, I spoke with President Hassan Rouhani of Iran. The EU supports the full implementation of the JCPOA, which, of course, is the Iran nuclear deal. Preserving a space for diplomacy underpinned by positive steps is crucial at this stage. So, you know, there was a meeting, as I said, before we came to you, between Michel and, you know, the German, French, British and U.S. secretaries of state, foreign ministers. They obviously want to go back into this. What do you think they can do now, for instance, to prevent Iran making good on its threat to cease or rather reduce cooperation with the IAEA nuclear inspectors?
That for me, Christian?
Yes.
Yes, sorry about that. Well, you know, I think the issue for Iran is that it has put itself in a position of asking that the United States take a step back into the deal. That because the United States is currently completely non-compliant, Iranians believe that asking them to become more compliant than they are without the United States actually taking even a step back into the deal is not viable for them domestically. There is a lot of hard position in Iran about the deal, about the trustworthiness of the U.S., about whether the Europeans are being honest brokers or are just basically taking the U.S.'s side. So the Iranians are very much worried about taking another step back without the U.S. reciprocating. So this game of chicken about who blinks first has become very key, and there is a need for a choreography between them. And at the same time, they're not talking to each other. So I think the Europeans need to persuade Iran to trust the process. And that's not going to be easy. And the Iranians are going to ask the Europeans to show some kind of an indication that this is going to move in the right direction. And that's exactly where we are now holding, with a major deadline looming next week, where the Iranian parliament has mandated that the Iranian government move away from the additional protocol and significantly reduce access of inspectors to Iran's nuclear program if the United States and the other signatories to the deal do not become more compliant than they have been thus far.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me now turn to Natalie Tocci, who has been an advisor to the foreign policy chiefs at the EU. And so let me put that question to you. And Natalie, let me just quote a few things that have come out of today's meeting. The German foreign minister said that Iran is, quote, playing with fire if it continues to threaten, to reduce compliance. We've heard the council president, Charles Michel, say that he believes there's room for diplomacy. He apparently had a conversation with the Iranian president. And the Iranian foreign minister told me at the beginning of this month that there is a way for the EU to help achieve some kind of synchronicity so that both sides can say they go back into the deal together. Can you break that down for me and tell me whether you think that's likely?
Well, I mean, Christiane, I think the first thing that I would say is that if the Iranians were not committed to the deal, they probably would have left the deal over the last 3 years. So the fact that they are raising the stakes now seems to me more of a signal of trying to ensure that there is movement on the US side as far as sanctions is concerned, rather than a signal of a lack of commitment to the agreement, because otherwise they would have left it, as I said, a long time ago. So it seems to me that in the game of chicken that you were mentioning, the risk is really that of inadvertently letting this opportunity slip. And this is, I think, where the Europeans come in, I think, at least two important ways. The first is indeed sort of keeping those lines of communication open and ensuring that there is a sequencing of sanctions relief per compliance ensuring that in that sequence, where obviously, as Vali was saying, the Iranian expectation is that who moves first is the party that left the agreement, meaning the United States, whether the Europeans can actually step in this respect in providing some of that economic relief if they are given the assurance by the United States that they will not be threatened with extraterritorial sanctions. So I think that the Europeans really fit in two respects. The first is really the sort of channel of diplomacy and the sequencing of these moves. And the second is stepping in on the sanctions relief front in doing perhaps what the United States will not be able to do immediately and what the Iranians expect.
So as we're speaking, the foreign ministers who are holding this virtual meeting, I guess, today have issued a statement in which they say the foreign ministers of Britain, France, Germany and the United States express their, quote, shared fundamental security interest in upholding the nuclear non-proliferation regime for Iran when they met. So let me put it to both of you now, whether you believe, given that the United States is the one who is out of compliance, who broke the deal unilaterally, and then, as you say, Iran has pretty much kept to it. Obviously, Iran has upped its uranium enrichment. Obviously, the EU and the US do not like that one little bit. This is what the Iranian foreign minister told me about the moves they're taking, whether it's on uranium enrichment or indeed on reducing cooperation tentatively with the IAEA inspectors. Take a listen.
Clearly, actions that Iran takes have always been monitored and verified by the IAEA. And we have shown that we fulfill our promises. The side that has not been able to show that it fulfills its promises has been the United States. And as I said, the United States needs to prove its bona fides. We have already proven our bona fides. If we are away from the strict limitations of the nuclear agreement, it's because the United States tried to impose a full economic war on Iran. Now, it stops that. Mm-hmm. We will go back into full compliance.
So Vali Nasser is clearly blaming the United States, and I think Europe believes that as well. The U.S. took the first move to remove itself from being compliant with this nuclear deal. So as you heard, the foreign minister saying that according to paragraph 36 in the JCPOA, they are acting in accordance with what is envisioned if one party breaks the deal, at least envisioned for their ability. Is that strictly true, Vali Nasser?
Well, an agreement like this is open to interpretation. The Iranian interpretation is that they can stay in the deal, but also stop complying with its terms because the other members are in the deal and they have stopped complying with its terms. So technically, both the Europeans, Chinese, Russians, and Iranians can be in the deal without complying with the terms that they signed on to. And I think that's where the Iranian foreign minister is sort of leaving the door open, that since we're all in the deal, we could just start complying with it. And you start complying, we start complying. But at the same time, Iran very clearly is trying to build leverage on the United States and the Europeans by enriching more uranium, but also by taking maybe certain actions outside of the deal. We've seen escalation in Iraq in the past week. We've seen reports of Iranian activity in Ethiopia. There is a worry that the kind of silence that we had in the region for the past 2-3 months of the Trump administration may come to an end. Clearly, the Iranians want to show that they have ability to make life difficult for the United States and the Europeans if they don't move forward. And even this threat of next week is part of this strategy, as well as indications that Iran has made some uranium metal, which is very strictly for nuclear weapons, and an announcement by Iran's Minister of Intelligence that if Iran remains under maximum pressure, it no longer will abide by a fatwa that the Supreme Leader gave that Iran will not seek nuclear weapons. So the Iranians are now escalating pressure on the Biden administration to make a move and to at least indicate that it's committed to going back to the deal. And then, as Natalie said, it can facilitate that the Europeans would bridge the gap until we get to a better place between the United States and Iran.
So let me ask you, Natalie, I mean, how much room is there to maneuver? Because we've heard Antony Blinken say, he's the U.S. Secretary of State, obviously, that Iran is out of compliance and it'll take a while to get back into compliance. We've heard today, again, from the White House podium, the spokeswoman saying that it's going to take a long time for Iran to get back into compliance. And again, Foreign Minister Zarif told me, and he actually wrote it in an article, that the U.S. campaign of quote, maximum pressure. In fact, under that time period, they expanded their stockpile of low enriched uranium from 660 to 8,800 pounds and upgraded centrifuges from other older models and have now new, more powerful models. How much of that is leverage that can go back into the box? And how much of that is a real issue in terms of trying to get, you know, both sides back into compliance, Natalie?
I mean, I think, Christian, from a technical standpoint, yes, there are obviously some technical timings to be respected, but we're not talking about, in a sense, sort of, you know, incredible amounts of time. I think the main point here really is that of breaking this deadlock, this political deadlock that we're in which what we're seeing is Iran raising the stakes in a manner that, you know, had it done what it's doing now last year or a year and a half ago, it would have clearly signaled its intention to exit the deal. The fact that it's doing it now can very clearly be read as raising the stakes for a negotiation. But of course, the problem is that there isn't a great deal of time for a negotiation to deliver before Iran itself enters its presidential election. So to me, it is not so much a question of the technical time that is required for compliance to take place, but the political time to ensure that there is a virtuous circle that is set in motion.
Okay, so that's another major issue because, as you say, it could be that a hardline, you know, a more hardline president and administration is elected in Iran. So, Vali, do you think that the United States is making, you know, is weighing up, you know, oh my goodness, should we try to do something under the Rouhani administration that we know we've worked with before, we secured the first deal, or should we wait and see what happens in the elections and who comes up? Do you think that the politics in Iran is a factor from what is a highly political issue in the United States?
Yes, absolutely. I think the politics in Iran is very important. If there is movement on the nuclear deal, more than likely the participation in election likely is going to be higher. That will favor the moderates. We may actually get some serious moderate candidates, which have yet to be enter the race. If there is no movement on the nuclear deal or there is no economic benefits coming to the Iranians, we're likely to have an election that's going to favor conservatives. And then if there's no engagement with the Rouhani government and, you know, Iranian elections are in June and then the new president in Iran comes to office in August, between now and August, if Iran keeps enriching and keeps pushing on the boundaries of JCPOA, we'll be in a much worse position in August than we are now. I also want to sort of put another spin on what Natalie said. It is very true that Iran has wanted to stay in this deal until now. But there has been a very powerful faction within Iran, in the security services, IRGC, among the conservatives, and even some of the senior advisors to the supreme leader, who have all along said that this deal was a mistake, and if we go back into it, it could be a trap. But this argument did not prevail because they were waiting for Biden. I mean, I cannot overemphasize how important this election in the United States was in the debate in Iran. Are we dealing with the United States or are we dealing with Trump? If Biden comes in and actually really initiates a new policy, starting with going back into JCPOA, then this deal may be worth it. Now, what we're seeing in Iran is that increasingly the voices that were saying there is no difference between Biden and Trump, the United States is not going to revive this deal, is going to use the leverages of the Trump period to continue to corner us. And in fact, Biden is more dangerous than Trump because he's going to be building bridges with the Europeans that the Trump couldn't. And we shouldn't go back in the deal. Those voices are going to become ascendant. There is a real debate in Iran that the waiting in Washington is helping the hardliners in that debate.
Well, and a likewise mirror image is happening in Europe, in the United States, and of course, influenced also by Israel. This is what Antony Blinken has said about the future. It's not just going back to status quo ante. They want to go even further. Let's play this.
If we're to get back into the deal, if Iran returns to compliance and we do the same, we need to work on an agreement that's longer and stronger than the original one. And we also need to engage other issues that were not part of the original negotiation.
So, Natalie, let me ask you, and then finally to Vali, any chance that they could, because obviously this is what you now want to talk about, missile program, Iran's influence and activities in places like Syria and elsewhere. Natalie, do you think that's even a starter? Do you think there's, you know, do they know that if the JCPOA is revived, that this will most definitely be on the menu in short order?
Well, it's obviously not a starter, but it is, I think, an endpoint. And the point is, though, when to start and ensuring that we do actually start. And you start by reviving the JCPOA itself, because that is what enables not only to actually deal with one key aspect, which obviously is the nuclear one, but perhaps even more importantly, to rebuild that trust, that minimum level of trust that then enables you not only to upgrade that agreement, given that one has to then eventually deal with the sunset clauses, but then tackle questions like regional questions. Now, on missiles, to be honest, I'm far more skeptical, but I think there would be scope to talk about regional questions if that trust building on the nuclear front is actually established.
Well, we're out of time now. We'll watch for the next meetings and what Iran does next week. And we'll be back to you. Vali Nasser and Natalie Tocci, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And we turn now to a fascinating look inside the Black Church in America. A new series examines its central role from slavery to emancipation, from the civil rights movement to Black Lives Matter, stretching back centuries. Through struggle, discrimination, and upheaval, the Black Church has been a place for African Americans to raise their voices in prayer and in song. Here's some of the trailer.
The Black Church gave people a sense of value, belonging, and worthiness. I don't know how we could have survived as a people without it.
To tell the story of American religion is to tell a political story.
The Black Church helped us to withstand all the slings and arrows of segregation and the segregationists.
The Black Church, this is our story, this is our song. It's on PBS and it is directed and produced by Stacey Holman, and she is joining me now from New York. Stacey Holman, it's an amazing piece of work. And let me just start by asking you, what did you find to be the difference between the Christian church in America? Did you know that there was this difference between so-called the Black Church and the other church?
Thank you for having me, Christian. And yes, I did. I think one of the most fascinating things about doing this whole series is how we started really on the continent of Africa, and the fact that all of the certain rituals and belief systems, though Africans, enslaved Africans, were stripped of their freedom, they were not stripped of their gods. So just seeing that this institution was really built from the ground up. It's a space of agency. It was a space of mobilizing. It was a space of also encouragement. So it was incredible to just tell this story and to see it just, you know, the church evolve from the very beginning.
So we know that Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates is the presenter, and you're the producer and the director, but he came to you with this idea of, I think, grappling with 400 to 500 years of the Black Church in America. I mean, what did you think when you were presented with that idea? And how did you come down to the 4 hours and you know, sort of decide what focus to have in each hour?
Well, took a deep breath, first of all. 400 years and 4 hours is a tremendous task. Said a lot of prayers, for sure. And I had an incredible team. I had another director, Shayla Harris, who directed 2 of the hours, and we had co-producers. And we also had an amazing group of advisors. That was one key element, asking them, what are the key stories that we need to tell? We knew that people would expect to hear about the civil rights movement, but what else could we say about the civil rights movement that was a little bit different or shine just a different light or a different lens on it? So with our advisors, also another producer, Kevin Burks, we just really dug in deep. And one thing, too, was this was also a personal story for Dr. Gates. He grew up in a Methodist church, and in the series, people who have not yet watched it, I won't do a spoiler alert, but he speaks about just how he came to the church and just really that personal story. So we wanted to also incorporate people's personal, as we'd say, testimony of how they came into the church, how the Lord had moved them and had touched them and carried them through a turbulent time or season.
You know, you say there's a lot that people know or think they know about the civil rights movement, about music, gospel, about all the things that we think we know. But I was struck in the first hour by how you go all the way back to the African slave, you know, slaves coming to the United States, and what the church meant to them, and also I was stunned, I really did not know this, that actually Islam came to the United States all those centuries ago with the slaves. And you find, you know, some remnants of Arabic Quran writing in a church that's lasted even to today.
Yeah, that was fascinating for me, too, for all of us, to know that there was an Islam footprint. And it just speaks to just the richness and the depth of how far back certain religions went on this continent. And to actually see, you know, going, first of all, to Sapelo Island and seeing the cemetery of Bilali Muhammad's descendants lie, and then to go to First African Baptist in Savannah, Georgia, and to see that inscription of a church that was built by free and enslaved Africans was also just a reminder that, you know, they might have left, but they did not leave those traditions. They did not leave those remembrances or those words or those writings, which are seen on the sides of the pews.
Before I go into the music, because obviously, you know, this is, you know, our lives, our song. How much real help, protection, you know, did the slaves, did Black Africans, Black Americans get from going into their churches? How much of a welcoming place was it? How easy was it for them in the very beginning to create these churches and churches that were separate from the white churches? I mean, weren't the slave owners kind of suspicious? Did they think they may be, you know, plotting how to escape and free themselves? Tell me about that.
Well, they were suspicious. We talk about invisible institutions. And what that exactly is, how it sounds. They would go into hush harbors, which were in the woods and forests and trees, and praise and worship. Because as enslaved Africans learned how to read, they began to understand and interpret the Bible for themselves. They understood about Moses, and they understood that God liberated the Israelites. They understood that, you know, Jesus was, you know, was a servant like them, was abused like them. So they found that what they were being denied in the word, as they began to read, they were teaching each other. And a lot of planters did not want that to be spread. So, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, even Savannah Church and First African Baptist, there was like some, you know, watchful white eyes that were sitting in the pews as people were preaching, as men, I should specify, were preaching. And that was a big deal until we get to Richard Allen, where they're like, you know what, which is the African Methodist Episcopal, and they completely separate themselves from the Methodists. And that's strictly because they're denied of sitting in the pews next to other white congregants. But it was very, it was a very fine line, and they had to be very careful on all fronts.
So obviously music is a huge, huge, huge part of the Black church. And I mean, there's a quote during the Civil War. One of the soldiers said that spirituals did more to free my people than all of the guns of the army. And we're going to play a clip of Ruther May Harris. She was one of the freedom singers in the 1960s. And here she's talking about the importance of music during the civil rights struggle.
Say you're walking down the street doing a march, and this policeman tell you you're going to be hit or whatever. Mm-hmm. You start singing, I ain't going to let nobody turn me around.
Right.
Not even the chief of police.
Not even a billy club.
Not even a billy club.
Talk to me about that, about music. I mean, you know, what you re-immersed yourself in, again, a part of the history of the church that you know. But did you learn anything extra or new about the music?
I did, especially when we get to the later hours of Hour 3. But even in the earlier part of just how hymns and spirituals just kind of transition to what we now hear in the civil rights songs that Ruther May sang with the SNCC Freedom Singers. But my biggest like OMG moment was Rosetta Tharpe and just her music, how it just really tried to cross over, but yet there was pushback from the church, and just how she was really trying to, as B.B. Winans says, you know, spread the gospel by singing and with her steel guitar and more public settings that were outside the confines of the church. But I also, too, just one thing that was amazing is just how, you know, the thread of music is also runs through the thread of just preaching, and how they both are synonymous mm-hmm. with each other. And you can't have one without the other.
I mean, that came across. And in fact, I think somebody even was mimicking how the tones of the music was reflected in the preaching tones as well. And it was very graphic example. It was really good. But I'm so glad you said Rosetta Tharpe, because I wished we could have played a clip, but she was amazing with her guitar, clothes, you know, I mean, amazing. We can't play a clip. I wish we could. She was really amazing. But that leads me, of course, to your focus on women, particularly in the third episode. And obviously, they're women we know. We know Ida B. Wells. We know, you know, Rosa Parks. We know Fannie Lou Hamer. But there are so many other women who played such an important role and who never really got as much knowledge, or rather as much, you know, renown. And particularly Prethea Hall. Tell me about her and I Have a Dream. I mean, it knocked my socks off.
Well, it's so ironic that who tells that story is now Senator Reverend Warnock, which is just incredible. But that was news to me as well. She was preaching in Georgia. She was a member of SNCC, dealing with voting registration. And Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King just happened to be there when she was saying a prayer. And while she was saying the prayer, she's like, I have a dream. I have a dream someday. And she keeps reciting this word over and over again. And he pretty much is like, wow, that was really good. I'm gonna borrow that. And we cut to the March on Washington, 1963, to the most historic, one of the most historic speeches. And he keeps using that refrain. And that was inspired by a woman. I had never heard of Prethea Hall before doing this series. And we asked everyone we interviewed, we asked them their top five pastors. And majority, at least 70%, mentioned her name. And I mean, and no one knew her. So I'm just privileged that people are now definitely getting to hear her name. She's going to get, you know, what she's due and put her contribution. It's not just with I Have a Dream, but just in the movement and just in the pulpit overall.
Mm-hmm. And what I found interesting was that in the program, I think it's Dr. Gates, he says that actually Martin Luther King took Prethea Hall to the airport or something, and told her that he liked that phrase and that he was going to use it. And I just want to give him his due, but I want to play Reverend Raphael Warnock talking to you about this, Reverend now Senator Warnock, and I just want to play what he said to you about it.
She began to talk to God aloud about what she desired for the world. And over again, she kept saying to God, I have a dream.
Really?
This was in Terrell County, Georgia, I believe in 1962. And so people need to know that before it was Martin's dream, it was Prethea's prayer.
I just think that's really beautiful. And as you said, you didn't know it. Many of us didn't know about that. But can I talk a little bit about a somewhat darker reality? That, you know, there was a lot of backlash too. I mean, churches were attacked back then and still, you know, today. And we've seen, you know, horrendous assaults on your churches. We remember what happened to the Emmanuel AME Church. And, you know, I want to ask you about that, because back in 2015, you know, the shooter came in and killed so many people. How does the history of the hopeful and the hateful sort of keep and still intertwines in the Black church in America?
Well, as long as the church, I mean, it's the one first place of agency, the first place that is independent, that's owned by Black people for essentially Black people, but its doors have always been open to every kind of people. So as long as it is that, it's always going to be a target. However, what I believe that, you know, doing this series and just from my own faith walk, just knowing that, you know, there's always belief, you know, it's more than these four walls. It's more than your circumstance. It's more than any situation. And we can look back in time and see just with enslaved men and women, and even through the civil rights movement and those moments in between, just it's that hope of something better. Is going to be around the corner. And I believe that is what really keeps the church going. But I also do believe that is really what makes it always a target.
And just the balm of the song throughout your history, everybody remembers President Obama breaking into Amazing Grace during the funeral service, the eulogy for the pastor who was killed by that white racist shooter. And we want to play a little clip of the singing.
Amazing Grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
It obviously speaks to resilience of the church and of the faith. But do you remember what you felt when you first heard that back in 2015?
It was fitting. It was moving and it was fitting. And it just, for me, it's like, what soothes you but song? What warms you but song and fellowship? And it was natural. And it just really kind of put that balm on that hurt and that pain and provided that peace.
So let me just ask you about today, because, you know, quite a few of, you know, the quite a few of the churches in your community, they struggle with a lot of what's happening today in the world, whether it's sexuality, whatever it might be, the role of women. There's still, like in the white Christian church, there's still political and religious struggles over our lives. And I wonder what you think and what you've found out from your investigation and these 4 hours, where your church is headed on these issues, and also the continual struggle between the secular and the sacred.
It's a question we asked everybody, what the future of the Black church was or is, and it varied in response. Some people thought it was very bright. Some people thought it's definitely a crossroad moment to figure out, okay, it's going to have to make some changes. Me personally, I'm in New York in the Harlem area, and there's a lot of churches that are dying out because of older congregations. And they're not bringing in a younger generation. And, you know, what I've taken away too is that there's a meeting between the two. I mean, there is a space to recognize and to honor the traditions of the church. However, traditions change. We need to move forward with it. And also, too, I feel that with today's generation, seeking to find fellowship in other ways, through social media, you know, transferring that to a dying church or an older generation, I think it could really give some new life to the church. And I feel like the season that we're in with COVID kind of really has almost done that in a natural, in an unfortunate way. But it's showing that, again, the church is still relevant, that people are desiring community. And I think as long as people are looking for community, as long as people are looking for hope, that people are going to still seek the church, and whether it's over a Zoom, whether it's actually when you gather, or whether it's in a open outdoor space. But, you know, most people of the ones that I did ask felt that there was a future in it. And I do believe, you know, despite all of the issues with LGBTQ and also with women, it's still relevant. And a lot of people are taking note of that. They are definitely recognizing, okay, there is some stuff we have to look at. We have to look under our own rug.
Well, we got a really great look, and it was really, really interesting. So, Stacey Holman, thank you so much indeed. Now, we continue The American Story with the award-winning director Lee Daniels, who's known for films like The Butler and the Oscar-winning Precious. His latest offering, The United States versus Billie Holiday, depicts how the jazz legend ended up on the wrong side of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. It was all down to her song Strange Fruit, a potent protest against lynching. The Bureau exploited Holiday's own drug addiction to try and silence her. Here's Daniel speaking to our Michelle Martin about that incredible story and his own struggles with addiction.
Thanks, Christian. Lee Daniels, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, in a new show, when we're trying to figure out who we want to talk to on a news event, we would say, why this person on this topic at this time? So I wanted to ask you this about this film. Why did you want to tell this story at this time?
I do films that are in my spirit, you know, whatever is in the air. And racism is interesting because unless they don't have to call you a nigger to you can smell it in the air. Systemic racism is real. It's an aerosol, and sometimes you can't touch it. And I felt that there was something going on. There was this darkness that was in the air, and that when the unmentionable got elected, and I knew that something was going on. I felt it. So I was drawn to this material that Susan Laurie Parks wrote, based on this book that Johan Hamri wrote. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time that I understood what Strange Fruit meant. I was attracted to this script because it was a call to arms. And it was something that I thought in my spirit I had to do because it was in the air.
You know, it's interesting because I think a lot of people know that Billie Holiday was one of the great singers of all time, certainly one of the great jazz singers. I think people may know that she struggled with addiction, but I don't know that a lot of people know of the government's role in pursuing her and in making her such a focus of this intense just obsession in a way, at least with some of the sort of bureaucrats. Would you just give us a little synopsis of the story that you're telling in this film?
It picks up with Billy first wanting to sing the song of Strange Fruit and the government not allowing her to sing that song, and her manager and her then husband trying to convince her to not sing it. And so we see this defiant woman wanting to sing a song that we try to figure, well, what is the song? Strange Fruit, what is the song? So, and then we find out that the government is, they don't want her to sing the song. The song is, it kicks off the civil rights movement as we know it. It's a call to arms.
So for people who are not aware, who have perhaps never heard it, what is Strange Fruit about?
Strange Fruit is about the lynching of Black people. It's a song about the lynching of us.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Billy was an international, global superstar. I think the equivalent to Beyonce, you know, around the world. And they didn't want her to sing the song. She refused to stop singing the song. So they couldn't hire white agents to infiltrate Harlem. So they hired Black agents to infiltrate Harlem to take her down, to stop singing the song. Mm-hmm. And she went to jail. And it's really what happens to her life post singing the song to the end, and how the government dogged her unto her deathbed, and how we even question whether they were responsible for her death, mm-hmm. planting drugs on her, anything they could to stop her from singing the song, paying off her boyfriends. The song could not be sung. Hoover did not want that song sung.
I cut Strange Fruit.
No, Joe, I want to sing the damn song, all right? The club advertises it. People pay good money to come here and hear me sing it.
I've told you 100 times, people in high places don't want you singing that song.
And I've asked you over 100 times, what people, Joe? What you looking at him for? I'm no one pays you.
The government.
Yeah, the government. People like your buddy Anslinger, right?
With it with that, huh?
The song means a lot to me, Joe.
Mirapol wrote it, and he's
f***ing commie.
Come on. I don't care, all right? It's important to me.
You ain't singing that song.
I sing the f*** I want.
I think, you know, it was blacklisted from the radio. It just, what is it you think was so frightening?
Well, I didn't know how frightening it was. And then I even heard it throughout the years. I didn't really understand the significance of it until I read the script. Black body swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from a poplar tree. It is, it's the ugliest thing I have heard. You know, the ugliest poem that I've ever read. And it's pungent and powerful and disturbing. It ain't pretty. Mm-hmm. And yet she made it. I don't know what she made it, but she made it so that we couldn't take our eyes off of her, Billy. And I was really happy that Andrew was able to, through God, really work miracles and reenacting that.
Is it true that you didn't really want her for the role at first? I think I read that you didn't want her. Is that true?
Yeah.
And why not?
It's a hard role. She's in every scene practically, and she carries the film. And so I really wanted to work with an actor, someone that had worked before, and I couldn't take that chance. And I loved her voice. I knew that she could understand what it was like, you know, as a vocalist. And I had gotten I was down to the wire with a couple of incredibly known actors that would have been able to pull it off, but they were acting. Mm-hmm. Difference, you know, there's a difference. She transcended. It was a spiritual awakening for me watching her audition. And so I met with her. I begrudgingly met with her, and she, I think with the first thing that I realized, oh my God, this woman is maybe right for this role, is because she was nervous herself. She had such respect for Billie Holiday that she didn't know that she could do her justice. And I'd never seen anybody talk themselves out of an audition. I've been around many. I said, this is a good stunt. This girl is really, she's a really good actress. I've been knowing. But she really was talking to herself, I don't know whether I can do this. And I said, well, let me put you with an acting coach. Let me put you a vocal coach. And I used my acting coach and my vocal coach, and I put them together. And the acting coach sent me a video of her getting into character. And her posture has changing. There was a dead in her eye. Her vocal had changed. I don't know what happened. And it was God speaking to me. I knew that it was God speaking to me. And so, and then I think the day after that, I saw her at the Academy Awards where she shut it down singing. And I knew that this was the girl to play this character.
I feel like your film is also generous toward Jimmy Fletcher, who, as you described, was the a real person, a federal agent who was, you know, the head of this team that went to infiltrate the Harlem scene, as it were, to be sort of, he was supposed to be the agent of her downfall. We have a clip with Jimmy and Anslinger, who's the government official who's sort of determined to take Billie Holiday down.
Pardon me for asking, but why is that song so important to us?
Hoover says it's un-American. You've heard those lyrics. They provoke people in the wrong way.
The wrong way. What would you have me do, sir?
You're a good liar. Now I need you to go down to the person and tell her you're sorry. She'll believe you. She's a sucker for men.
A lot of black people are put in that position. My dad was. My dad was a cop at the height of the movement in Philadelphia. And I remember him coming home crying. And it was, and I, you know, I was terrified of my father. He was abusive. But I remember feeling so sad for him. I'd never ever seen him cry before. So I think that there are lots of Jimmy Fletchers that are out there, lots of us that are doing it out there. And I think that there, again, there's a gray witness to Jimmy. And that was the hardest role because it was like walking a tightrope. It was the hardest role to direct because he took her down. And so, and then, so why is he showing up and how are we, why are we even liking this guy? Mm-hmm. But we see that he was wrong. We see that he knows that he is being used.
I wonder if, in addition to being a character himself and being having been a real person who played a real role in the story, is there a bigger metaphor here about the dilemma that some Black people are confronting?
Oh, come on now. You know, Michelle, what the bigger metaphor. I mean, come on. We are living it daily. We see it daily. You know, some of these cops that are out here doing what they're doing, it's horrible. You know, I'm thinking about doing a procedural. And but what is a cop show right now? What is a cop show right now? The idea of are they the good guys or the bad guys? And the stories that I'm hearing from Black cops right now, I don't want to tell those stories.
Mm.
I do not want to tell those stories.
Why not?
It's too sad.
Mm.
Too sad. We got some unhappy Black men out here that are serving our country. Serving our country in, you know, as cops.
One of the things that always strikes me about your films is the contrast between the beautiful and the terrible. I mean, on the one hand, a lot of your women characters are very strong and have their own sense of being, and yet they are not immune from being brutalized. And yet, I don't know, that duality seems to interest you. I want to hear more about that. The duality of it, both the beautiful and the terrible.
Because we are, we really are. We're not one, I don't think. I think that, you know, for as tough as I am, I'm really, really weak. You know, I'm tough and I'm weak. And I'm good and I'm bad. And I wake up every morning and I try to become I want to be a good example for my kids, but I fall on my ass. And so I look at the imperfections in everyone and to try to find the perfection in the imperfection in all of us. And I think in particular, in my story, in Black cinema, I think that we are, oftentimes it's not, we're the hero and that's that, or we're the bad guy and that's that. But we don't live in that gray area. And I like to live in that. I like to settle in that gray area. And that gray area is very disturbing to many people.
You get things out of people. People say they're not sure other directors could get. And why do they trust you so much to go to these difficult places? Because you're asking them to take on and to channel a lot of pain.
Mm.
Why do you think they trust you to do that with them?
I think because I am so raw and honest, Michelle, in my day-to-day with them, that I talk about my insecurities. I talk about my inability as a director to find the scene, that I'm scared. Help me find the scene. And they see my fragility and my vulnerability. And that makes them vulnerable too. They know everything about me. There's no secrets. I have no secrets when I'm working with an actor. My life is an open book. And when they're relaxed and they're open to receive, I yell action and they're in it and they don't even know what happened. I don't even know what happened, but we have found it because we are pure. We're honest with each other in the moment. Mm. So everything you see is real, very real.
Well, speaking of being very open, you've been very open about your own struggles around addiction in the past. I know you talked to me about it in the past, and I understand that subsequently you've even given up drinking, that you're sober. You're completely sober now. And I wondered, did those experiences find their way into the character? Your experience with addiction, because you have been highly productive the entire time you were going through all this, as she was. And I just wondered, did that experience find its way into the story?
Yeah, I mean, how can you be successful? I don't know how I did it. Mm. You know, I'm trying to heal myself. I was trying the only way I knew how, and I think the only way Billy knew how, and that was to anesthetize yourself from the pain of your childhood, of the darkness that you've encountered. You're just trying to heal. You're trying to live. Mm. And so when you yank that away, that blanket away, that cover that makes you feel good, it's terrifying. So it's a dangerous thing for me to do this film sober. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's good, to be honest with you. I hope it's mm-hmm. good. I don't know whether it's good. I can't. I'm never going to go back and look at it. But I'm not as confident about it as I am. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Really? Why?
Because I'm not boozed. If you're boozed, everything's good. You know what I mean? Mm. I'm not as confident as I am when I'm using.
What allowed you to finally release that? What allowed you to finally let that go? The boozing, the drugs? Because it sounds like you really kind of stepped out on the plank and jumped. What made you, what allowed you to do that?
What allowed me to do that was, I just think it was time. It was just time. It was time. I'm 60. I've been drinking for all of my life. And 4 years ago, I decided, as we began on this journey with Billy, to stop completely, to live in my truth, because I knew that I had to tell this story. I knew that for me to honor her, I had to tell it sober. It may not make sense to you. It may not make sense to you, but it makes sense to me. I could not honor this act. Hi.
Lee Daniels, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Michelle, thank you so much for having me. I look forward to coming back again and again.
And how startlingly honest and vulnerable he was. The US versus Billie Holiday will be streaming on Hulu from next Friday. And that is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.